prepara las palomitas. Está a punto de empezar En Sincronía, el podcast hispanoamericano de traducción audiovisual, con Damián Santini, Blanca Arias Badía y Guillermo Parra.
Les damos la bienvenida al episodio número 32 de En Sincronía, el primer podcast de traducción audiovisual del mundo. Soy Damián Santilli y estoy sincronizado desde Buenos Aires, Argentina, con Blanca Arias Badía en Barcelona y Guillermo Parra todavía en Menorca, Guille.
En Menorca, pero con un pie en Canadá también, porque estoy a punto de irme ya. Para cuando se emita este episodio, a lo mejor ya estoy volando hacia allí.
¡Qué magia! Bueno. Eso es magia.
La magia de los aviones.
La magia.
Hola Blanca, ¿cómo va?
El diferido.
Hola, bien, aquí de final de curso. Vosotros a punto de vacaciones de invierno, ¿no? Y nosotros a punto de vacaciones de verano.
Vacaciones de invierno, sí, cortitas. El descanso es muy breve, así que... Pero viene bien igualmente. Porque ya a esta altura del año...
Siempre viene bien.
Sí, además este año post-COVID, en cierta medida, ha sido bastante intenso. Así que bueno, ahí estamos. Bueno, muy bien. Hoy tenemos un programa especial. Otra vez vamos a entrevistar en inglés. Nuestra invitada de hoy va a ser Agnieszka Jarkowska. Pero vamos primero a contarles de nuestro patrocinador de Una, la mejor herramienta en línea para creación, traducción y edición de subtítulos y closed caption para todos los idiomas. Una tiene una interfaz web muy intuitiva y fácil de usar que nos permite trabajar como profesionales de la manera más sencilla. Pueden ingresar en una.net para probar el software gratis durante 4 semanas, mejorar su productividad y empezar a trabajar hoy mismo como profesionales. Y bueno, como les contaba, nos animamos otra vez a entrevistar en inglés, una entrevista muy interesante con, bueno, Agnieszka Jarkowska. Agnieszka es Associate Professor del Instituto de Lingüística Aplicada de la Universidad de Varsovia. Es investigadora, docente académica, ex traductora, como se define ella misma, capacitadora de traductores y asesora en accesibilidad en los medios. Es directora de ABT Lab, ahí en la Universidad de Varsovia, uno de los primeros grupos de investigación en traducción audiovisual. Y bueno, investigan sobre varios temas, pero uno de los temas principales de su investigación, que es eye tracking para subtitulados sobre todo, es el tema, uno de los temas principales de la entrevista que vamos a hacer hoy. Y bueno, también investigan sobre voiceover, audiodescripción, multilingüismo, subtitulado para sordos, rehablado, bueno, en fin, de todo un poco. Así que vamos a tener una entrevista muy interesante con ella, que bueno, se nos ocurrió invitarla porque había sido Agnieszka la keynote speaker del Language Endemia 2021, así que allí presentó un montón de cuestiones relacionadas, bueno, no solo con su investigación, sino también principalmente con las nuevas tendencias de la traducción audiovisual. Así que en la entrevista de hoy vamos a charlar sobre las nuevas tendencias y también sobre lo que nos puede enseñar el eye tracking con respecto al subtitulado. Así que, bueno, esperamos que disfruten de la entrevista. Y como siempre, además, vamos a tener nuestras secciones. Y hoy vamos a comenzar con minutos divulgativos, Blanca.
Sí, yo esta vez he invitado a Florian Bardini de la Universidad de Vic, Universidad Central de Cataluña, que... Bueno, porque quería que nos hablase de su tesis doctoral, que ha ganado un premio muy importante en Cataluña del Consejo de lo Audiovisual, y es una tesis que trata de distintos estilos de audiodescripción y cómo mejorar la experiencia de los usuarios en función de estos distintos estilos. Entonces ella misma nos va a contar de qué trata la tesis y lo que ha descubierto con ella.
Muy bien. Después de la primera parte de la entrevista, vamos a tener los subtítulos con carácter. Guille.
Pues sí, yo me imagino que todo el mundo estará esperando que dedique los subtítulos con carácter a Stranger Things. Lo que pasa es que debo reconocer algo terrible, y es que no la he visto. Aún no la he acabado de ver. Lo sé. A lo mejor en el siguiente episodio...
Son muy largos los capítulos.
Claro, es que ahora mismo no me da la vida, pero voy a hablar de algo que...
Capítulos como una película, digamos.
O más, ¿no? Es como...
Los últimos son dos.
Los últimos capítulos son como el irlandés, vamos. Y bueno, como en este caso no he podido ver la serie del momento todavía, que espero a poder hacerlo de cara a próximos episodios, pues en este caso voy a hablar de una película que me ha llamado la atención a mí, no sé si a nuestros oyentes también, confío en que sí, que se llama Hustle, Garra en español, y me ha llamado la atención como buen fan del baloncesto que soy, que de hecho también he comprobado que Adam Sandler, que es uno de los protagonistas de la película, también es fan del baloncesto, porque ya lleva varias películas donde el baloncesto es un elemento fundamental. Y no he hablado mucho de temas así, técnicos o específicos, y como este a mí me interesa, pues voy a analizar la traducción desde el punto de vista del baloncesto.
Muy bien, muy bien. Bueno, y después de la segunda parte de la entrevista, yo en el laboratorio visual les voy a contar de un experimento que hice para Aptec en el año pasado sobre traducción automática, ya que nos quedamos con ganas de hablar un poco de ese tema en más detalle en esta temporada. Bueno, vamos a aprovechar la sección para hablar de eso. Y ya que hablamos de temporada y cierre de temporada, les queremos contar que este es el anteúltimo episodio de esta segunda temporada. La semana que viene, o sea, una semana después de la publicación de este episodio, bueno, para quienes no lo escuchen en directo, puede ser inmediato, o puede ser después, o puede ser antes. Pero bueno, el miércoles que viene, en concreto, 13 de julio, vamos a hacer nuestro último episodio dedicado al Hispatab. Vamos a tener... como nosotros tres vamos a estar en el Hispatab, vamos a hablar nosotros de nuestras cosas también, pero vamos a tener invitados sorpresas que van a ser, obviamente, invitados que también van a participar del Hispatab, así que van a tener en las redes la información del horario del episodio y todo lo demás. Obviamente que si se lo pierden después lo van a poder escuchar grabado, por supuesto que sí, pero para quienes escuchen a tiempo este capítulo... los invitamos a que nos acompañen el próximo miércoles 13 de julio a la grabación en vivo, que va a ser vía YouTube, del episodio final de la segunda temporada, en donde vamos a hacer la previa del segundo Congreso Hispanoamericano de Traducción Audiovisual.
Y para todos los que no lo escuchen ese mismo día, ya tienen suficiente castigo con darse cuenta de que no han recibido este aviso a tiempo, por lo tanto, tienen que aprender a escuchar los episodios.
Exacto, en vivo, apenas sale. Claro.
Exacto. Nada más que aparecen en la web y en las plataformas, por favor, todo el mundo a descargarlos, porque si no...
se pierden cosas, claro.
Claro, claro.
¿Kishi, ibas a decir algo?
Sí, no, bueno, yo iba a decir que evidentemente que lo escuchen, que seguro que les interesará, que no es un sustituto del congreso en sí, que tienen que asistir si pueden, que no se lo pierdan porque va a ser espectacular.
Exactamente, exactamente. Muy bien, Kishi.
La bomba. Me gusta.
Y quedan muy poquitos lugares, vamos a insistir con eso en el episodio de la próxima, pero creo que quedan 40 lugares, una cosa así, así que no se pierdan la oportunidad de ver. Y bueno, y la realidad es que vamos a tener invitados sorpresa para el episodio, así que van a tener que venir a escucharnos en vivo para ver quiénes son, quiénes nos van a acompañar. Bueno, muy bien, sin mucha más dilación, entonces vamos a comenzar con nuestro episodio de hoy, con los minutos divulgativos y después la primera parte de la entrevista a Agnieszka Szarkowska.
En este podcast no nos gusta que la investigación sobre traducción audiovisual y accesibilidad se quede guardada en un cajón. Empiezan los minutos divulgativos con Blanca Arias Badía.
Hola, en estos minutos divulgativos estamos de celebración porque una tesis doctoral sobre audiodescripción que se leyó en el 2020 sobre audiodescripción en la Universidad de Vic, que fue a cargo de Florian Bardini y dirigida por Eva Espasa, que nos acompañó en el episodio sobre género en este podcast, ha ganado uno de los premios más importantes que hay en Cataluña de medios audiovisuales, que son los premios del Consejo de lo Audiovisual de Cataluña, las siglas son CAC, sobre investigación en comunicación audiovisual. Se trata de la tesis La transposición del lenguaje cinematográfico en la audiodescripción y la experiencia fílmica de las personas con discapacidad, está en catalán, os voy a dejar el enlace en la cajita de información. Y tenemos la suerte de contar con su autora, con Florian Bardini, que ya me ha dicho que la disculpemos porque el español es su tercera lengua, pero ya veréis qué cosas tan interesantes nos va a contar sobre su tesis. Adelante, Florian.
Hola, Blanca. Hola a todos y muchas gracias por convidarme. Me gusta esto de que las tesis no se queden en un cajón. Pues voy a presentar muy rápidamente los resultados de mi tesis, que fue un estudio de recepción sobre estilos de audiodescripción, donde pusimos a prueba la interpretación del lenguaje cinematográfico en la audiodescripción para ver si podía ofrecer una mejor experiencia a las personas con discapacidad visual que la audiodescripción más objetiva que se prescribe en las normas actuales. Elegimos el cortometraje Nuit Blanche, que es muy visual, no tiene diálogo, tiene muchos efectos especiales de cámara, etcétera, para transmitir su mensaje, y lo creamos en tres audiodescripciones diferentes. Una convencional, objetiva, siguiendo la norma actual, y dos interpretativas que incluyen el lenguaje cinematográfico para trasladarlo en las palabras de la descripción. Una de estas dos versiones interpretativas es una versión cinematográfica que incluye, además de la interpretación, algunas informaciones de vez en cuando sobre el encuadre, sobre un movimiento de cámara. Y la última versión es narrativa. En esta nos tomamos algo de libertad a la hora de describir la imagen en un momento dado, porque el objetivo es crear una narración que transmita todo lo transmitido por el lenguaje cinematográfico a lo largo de todo el cortometraje o de toda la película. Pusimos estas versiones a prueba con 45 personas con discapacidad visual a Cataluña, y los resultados nos aportaron diversas informaciones muy interesantes. Por un lado, pudimos concluir de las preguntas y valoraciones que los tres estilos proporcionaban un acceso bueno y similar al cortometraje en cuanto a comprensión y acceso a una experiencia agradable. Más allá de estos aspectos más generales, las dos versiones interpretativas ofrecían una experiencia más emocional, ofrecían más inmersión y también una experiencia más similar a la de las personas sin discapacidad visual. Finalmente, la audiodescripción cinematográfica y la audiodescripción narrativa también fueron las audiodescripciones mejor valoradas por las personas participantes.
Muchísimas gracias, Florian. Es un gusto que la investigación que tiene impacto social como la tuya tenga estos reconocimientos. Enhorabuena y a seguir adelante con otros proyectos de investigación. Nos vemos en los próximos minutos divulgativos.
Well, hi everyone, we're here with Agnieszka Szarkowska. I'm sure I didn't say that right, but I'm very sorry, Agnieszka, for that. Welcome
to
our show.
Oh, you
well.
Actually did, Agnieszka Szarkowska, well done.
Okay, that's great. I should have practiced more, but okay. So we're really happy to have you here. Thank you for taking a time at this really difficult moment in the year where everyone has no time at all to join us and to be with us. And I'm sure that everyone at the other side is going to enjoy very much talking to you. So we're going to start this interview with something we do with all of our participants, with everyone we interview. We're going to ask you about your beginnings in AVT, because we talked about this with Jorge Diaz-Cintas, Frederic Chaume, and it's always a surprise to see how they actually started in AVT. So why don't you tell us about that?
Right. Well, first of all, thanks for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. It's a great pleasure. I've been following the podcast as much as I could, but most of it is Spanish, so I just listened to the English episodes. My beginnings so long ago. So I studied English at the University of Warsaw and Polish, I've always wanted to do something hands-on and applicable, relevant to real life. So when I was a student, I chose translation. And the most interesting thing in translation studies, I thought, is subtitling. So I wrote my MA thesis on interlingual subtitling. And I remember there were hardly any books. We had one old book with a paper by Henrik Gottlieb and another paper by Yves Combier. So these were the names I knew. And then I remember my supervisor came to me one day and she said, "Oh, I've got you a book on subtitling. So I ran to the library and then I found the book, like the first book on subtitling, and it turned out to be SDH, not interlingual subtitles.
Oh, okay.
So disappointed. But then I had another look, you know, and I thought, wow, this is cool. This is interesting too.
What book was that?
That was the book by McKay, the little black book describing the study that they did with deaf people in the UK, an eye tracking study.
Okay.
The title escapes me now, but yes. So, you know, my first book and already on SDH and eye tracking.
The semiotics of subtitling, are you talking about that one? You said Delinda and Kay?
Yes, that's it. The semiotics of subtitling, yes. Zoe Delinda and Neil Kay.
You have it on your desk?
I'm at work now and all my good books are actually at home. So I can't check now. Yeah, but that was the book. But then I, you know, I did my MA and I was looking for a job in AVT, but at that time there were no global streaming companies and it was quite tricky actually to get a job in AVT if you didn't know anyone, and I didn't know anyone.
Can I ask you, when was it? Where was this?
Oh God, this was, when did I do it? 2002 or three, more or less.
Okay.
I think, ages ago. So.
Nah, it's not that ages ago, okay. Well, I'm from 2005, six, but we're young. We're very young, so. It's not ages ago.
Let's okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. You see, I can't even retrieve the date. So I was like, you know, I left university and I just found a job as a translator, and the only job in translation I could find was as an in-house translator. A translator is in a Yellow Pages company, like not a very big corporation, but I was just doing legal things and business thing, and then I became a certified translator, and I was doing different contracts, certificate, diplomas, very boring things, and think of it now. So, and then gradually, you know, I was becoming more bored with this, and more opportunities opened up for me. So I started doing interlingual subtitling, English to Polish, and also SDH, Polish to Polish. But to be honest, the jobs I was getting, you know, were not really, you know, big blockbusters for cinematic releases, super exciting stuff. They were like, some of it were, you know, mid-range kind of things, or even horrible TV shows. And something I didn't watch myself as a viewer. And I was like, I don't know, I was doing this show, A Thousand Ways to Die, and just wanted to, oh my God, awful. So, you know, or some Polish soap operas for SDH. And I just found myself thinking, you know, is this something I want to do? And I thought, well, I think, you know, I'm better suited for something else. So now when I need to subtitle something, it's just I love it now, and it's relaxing, and you know, it's it allows you to do something tangible easily. So it's like a relaxing hobby now, but I don't have to do it for a living. Mm. And to be honest, I don't think I was a great translator in the first place. I enjoyed it, but you know, I realized that some other people have like maybe more talent for this, and my talent was just somewhere else, and I discovered.
You were discouraged by the fact that you didn't get to do like blockbusters and all that, or just that you didn't like sitting around 8 to 10 hours translating?
No, I think this was the quality of the shows that really discouraged me. Yeah, I sit 8 to 10 hours anyway.
Yeah.
That doesn't discourage me, no. Yeah, so I guess that's the story, yeah.
Yeah, so you worked in as a translator up to when exactly?
Oh, it's difficult to say because, you know, I think I'm like typical person of modern times in the sense that it's not like my parents that they had one job that they continue for, you know, most of their adult life. You just do this and that, right? When I started my PhD at university, I got a job. I would sometimes do some odd jobs here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very bad with dates, sorry.
Did your supervisors discourage that? Did your supervisors discourage you to accept the translation jobs and things like that? Because mine did. Like, focus on the thesis. Don't do anything on the side.
Well, easy to say when you have to pay your bills, right?
Exactly.
No. My supervisor was a lovely man. I think he was 84 when I started. I actually have his picture here in my office.
Guillermo's supervisors were Patrick and Edward Bartoy. They are also very nice.
So younger.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, and so obviously your supervisors understood the need to work in the industry, right? To know what you're talking about if you're writing research on this. My supervisor was more into applied linguistics kind of thing. I didn't have anyone who was in AVT at the time when I started, so it was a bit tricky for me.
So, and then how was the transition, let's say, to research entirely? So
I got completely bored with my job in the corporation, and I quit. Something was missing in my life, so I just decided to go back to university, and I started doing my PhD. And I wrote my PhD on Polish to English subtitling, soap operas, but forms of address. So you see, this quality of show stayed with me for a while.
Your thesis was about how boring they are?
No, I was actually trying to concentrate on something more, scientific. I collected a large, at the time, corpus of those operas, and I was just trying to investigate those the techniques or the phenomena that most people talk about, like when you have forms of address, what happens in subtitling, particularly in the vocative case, and there were some funny things going on. But that was ages ago, and if you were asking me about the date, I got my PhD in 2007. That's one thing I remember.
We do this because I think it's important to people to know, especially the ones that are already starting in this profession, to know that it takes time, you know, because many times we see students discouraged because they see someone important dealing with subjects and saying, okay, I'm never going to be like you. Okay, but you know that I am here because I've been doing this for 15 years, for 20 years. So that's why we do it.
That's really important. Yes, you just maybe young people now are more impatient or something to get things. I don't know. Yeah, but it, of course, it takes a while. Yeah.
You start with reality TV, documentaries of all kinds, soap operas, whatever they throw at you. That's what you do, and you do it well, and you get experienced, and you get ready for when more and enticing things come up.
Yes, ideally, yeah, you don't end up with them, you know, because maybe they will classify you as a person who specializes in that, and then you're just...
specializes in soap operas, so it's going to be in a very bad position all your life.
Right, you don't want to have that on your CV now.
Okay, so let's talk about the present now. You're head of the ABT lab. And you say it's one of the first research groups on ABT. So can you tell us about who's working with you there and what are you currently researching?
Yes, sure. So when I was starting, people would just work, individually, and it wasn't really something popular to work as a group, as a research group. Now I'm very happy to say this has changed, and I'm very happy to have so many talented younger people around me. So let me just tell you a few things about who I am working with right now and who do we have in the team. So I have two doctoral students right now, Gabriela and Sonia. Gabriela is working on the perception of dubbing, and she did this study recently on differences in perception between traditional dubbing that was created by human translators versus AI dubbing that was created using video synthesis software, where rather than matching the translation to the lip movements of the original actors, what is done is they change the mouth movements in the video to match the text.
Mm.
And so she did this eye tracking study recently, and turned out that people didn't really see any differences between human-made dubbing and the dubbing made by artificial intelligence, which is pretty scary, I think.
Yeah. I would say.
Yes. So that's one thing. I also have this grant research project that my other doctoral student Sonia works on. The project is called Watch Me, and it's just yet another eye tracking study on reading subtitles, but it's really exciting what we can do with our brand new fancy eye tracker. So we are able to study the reading of subtitles at the word level, and maybe you don't appreciate my excitement. What we used to do before with the all eye tracker, and that's what most people did until recently, was whenever you studied subtitled video, you had to draw what is called areas of interest, so those rectangles on the video, because the subtitles were burnt into the video, and with frame by frame accuracy, you would draw every at this rectangle on every single subtitle, and you had like 100,000 subtitles, you just it would just take forever.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah,
it's well worth that. weeks of boring work, and now we're just able to integrate. We take subtitle file and we create, and we just integrate everything, and we have this lovely automatic functionality. Nobody has to draw those areas of interest any longer. We just get it at a click. So we're very excited about that, and we're researching the impact of speed and sound on the processing of subtitles. And it's not only me and Sonia. I have this lovely postdoc, Valentina, who moved to Poland to work with us. So she's courageous. And we have an international team as well. So in the project, we also have Jan-Louis Kruger from Australia, Sharon Black from the UK, and Davide-Rego Carmona from the UK as well. So we're doing those things. And together.
I wanted to ask kind of a silly question, because I'm not very experienced with experimental research, but does the eye tracking apply to other translation modes apart from subtitling in a visual translation, like accessibility or dubbing? Is it useful for any other mode?
That is a very good question, actually. I think you can use it for different purposes. So I tend to work with subtitling recently, but Gabi, my PhD student that I just mentioned, she is using eye tracking to study, how people watch dubbed videos, whether there is or there is not this dubbing effect, right? So you can basically see whether people are like focusing on the mouth a lot or not, and then you're trying to interpret what that means. We also used eye tracking to study audio description, and you may think, how does that work? Audio description. That would be a very good question. So what we did, we tried to answer this research question whether audio description in educational videos, not entertainment videos, but in education, would be also useful for other types of viewers, so not only blind and partially sighted. And we went to primary school with kids, and we found that audio description actually helps them focus, because while they are listening to those descriptions, this was something about, you know, white cells and red cells and things like that. So people who were watching with audio description could follow those things that were being described on the video in the image and had better results. So a very good question. Yeah, so we use that for dubbing, for subtitling, for audio description. Yeah.
That's great. I just wanted to go back just a little bit with the AI for dubbing. You've mentioned in Languages in the Media that there might be some copyright problems or something like that with the image of the actors and actresses. How far can we go with that?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there are things online that are not exactly legal, right?
So I think
it's really important to make sure that all those videos that were doctored, let's say, that were changed using this video synthesis technology, that they are clearly marked so that people can understand this is not the real thing. You can Google like what they did to President Barack Obama, what he was saying. So there are a lot of videos of Barack Obama available online. And what you can do, you can use this deepfake technology, right? Video synthesis. Yeah. Deepfake, sometimes it's called, right? To change somebody's lip movements, and you can make them say whatever you want to say. So this is a very dangerous technology. It was.
It's the one where he criticizes Trump, right? It's like.
Yes.
He says something like very, very straightforward about Trump, and it's like, no, it's not me saying that, it's someone else.
Precisely. Yes, and this technology was used, you know, when I don't know, your girlfriend broke up with you, and then, you know, you just found your own video online if you're a famous actor or actress, you know, doctored. So it's very dangerous in this sense, but it's also very promising when you think about
dubbing.
Dubbing, yes.
So it's a shame that it's a technology that is already linked to something very dangerous like deepfake, you know. So
yeah,
because I think that for dubbing would be very, very awesome to have that. If indeed there is, you can find, I don't know if you already have some results, but you can find that actually people do pay attention to lip movement or in to what extent they do. Because, I mean, that's something that you might be asking, right?
Yes. Actually, we have some preliminary results. So on the one hand, people declare not to notice any differences. We show them this video, that video. They just don't know. They didn't notice anything strange. But when you look into eye tracking, which is a more objective, let's say, measure, you can see, and this is what we found, that many more people when watching AI dubbing were looking much more at the subtitle, at the lips, rather than those people who were watching just, you know, the English original or the human dubbing. So there is
something. Interesting.
Yeah. So when you, it's like a typical phenomenon in audiovisual speech processing when, or you can remember from the times of the pandemic, right? When people would wear masks and you couldn't see their lips. So you're focusing, when you can't understand what somebody's saying, you're focusing much more on their mouth, right? And it was so difficult with the mask.
What do you tell your subjects so that it doesn't influence the results of the project? Because I guess you can tell them what you're looking for, right? You have to trick them into thinking that you're assessing something else, or how do you do it?
Oh, we typically tell them that, you know, they need to watch carefully because they're going to be tested on comprehension, and we give them comprehension questions. So that's what they focus on the content. Which, you know, we give them comprehension questions, so it's not a lie. We just don't tell the entire truth.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense.
Makes sense. Yeah. So I think we might have your students in the future in our podcast, because it's very interesting to hear more about this. So going, let's keep talking about eye tracking. So you recently published a new paper on eye tracking. You've been publishing on this subject for many years now, but we're going to, with a geeky question, as Blanca mentioned when I showed her the questions that we have prepared for you.
Now we're going to lose some listeners for the
no,
next
no,
few minutes,
come on.
But it doesn't matter.
No, but we want you to talk about the linear mixed models and how can, they can help with that tracking research in comparison with
stay with us. Don't go away.
Stay with us because we're going to ask Agnieszka another question then for a younger audience.
Younger and not as geek.
Yeah. But we are geek. We had to ask. So and that's
yeah. Don't worry. I'm not going to start a lecture on mixed models now because this is something I'm learning myself. This is like mind bending, advanced statistical method, more powerful statistical method than before that enables us to look into more fine grained details. If you think about previous eye tracking studies, what was done. We used methods like t-tests or ANOVAs. So you would have, I don't know, when you wanted to study how many fixations, so how many times, let's say, a person looked into a subtitle, okay? With these old methods, you had to aggregate everything. So sum everything up and one participant, you just had one number. So for all the subtitles in the clip that they watched, I don't know, 200 subtitles, you just had one average number. So let's say three times this participant looked at the subtitle, okay? And some other participant, I don't know, five times, okay? Mm-hmm. So you were losing a lot of data by averaging. And now, thanks to linear mixed effect models, what we do is we can look at every single word in the subtitle or every single subtitle. So depending on whether this subtitle contains some difficult words, some low frequency words, some not very common words, right? Or some specialized term, we are able to put that into the model and see, you know, oh, this has an impact and this has an impact. This wasn't possible before. I can continue, but
what kind of impact are you looking to know about? With the reading speed or the segmentation? What
currently we are still working on speed, so you can look into the speed. But we're doing some different things, so we're not only now grouping speed into, I don't know, fast or slow subtitles, but we are taking the subtitles as they are, precisely synchronized with the audio. So every subtitle has a different reading speed, right? I don't know, ranging from, I don't know, 10 to 25 CPS. And then you are able to see how the rise in speed impacts the reading of subtitles. Mm-hmm. And we can also factor in the impact of particular features or characteristics of particular, not only subtitles, as I said, how many words in a subtitle, how many difficult words, etc., but participants themselves. So we're looking into, you know, whether there are any differences between people who are used to subtitling or who are not used to subtitling, who are native speakers, who are not native speakers, who, I don't know, have this proficiency in English or, you know, low or high. So you can put that all together and mixed models allow you to, you know, get some numbers and try to figure that out.
Okay, so and when I was thinking about all your research and all that, I can help but think about Netflix and how they change everything from one day to another, you know, and how the, for instance, the reading speed, they decided that they wanted to make it faster for all the languages and all that. So what are your impressions in general with these moments in time in a profession when a company comes and really is, I don't want to say that they don't care about research in academia and what and actually what we've been doing for decades, but I mean, they just do their thing. And then many other companies and professionals start copying, you know, what they do. What can you say about that?
You've raised a number of interesting points. So in terms of
Thank you so much.
I think it revolutionized everything. On the positive side, I'm very impressed with their transparency. So if you think about what happened previously, were you able to look into the style guides of different companies? No, because they were like in-house style guides only available to a few people who could access them, right? And it was quite tricky for audiovisual translator trainers, you know, what kind of style guide you're going to use. And now Netflix made everything available. So I think that was a very good move. Now, what they put in the guidelines is a different thing, right? where they got that from, I don't know. That's a very good question, right? So I think there is a lot of protests, particularly from Scandinavian countries and Scandinavian and subtitlers who are doing subtitling in a certain way, and they think that's the best
way. It's a big change for them. Yeah.
It is a big change for them. It's a big change for their viewers, but... I'm not sure if we want to go into this. So perhaps I can say one thing about Netflix guidelines that we were just discussing the other day here with people in our research group. So if you think about this Netflix rule of minimum subtitle duration, which currently I think is 800 milliseconds.
800 milliseconds, yeah.
So it's even below 1 second. Where did that get that 20 from?
20 frames, yeah.
20 frames, which is like more or less 800 milliseconds, I think, right? Depending on the frame rate that you have. This is very problematic, because when you think about that, so you have this subtitle that is displayed on a screen for less than a second, 800 milliseconds, let's say, and it's not that you, as a viewer, immediately start reading this subtitle, okay? You are there with your eyes waiting for a subtitle to appear in the subtitle area. No, what you're doing is like you're watching the video, right, most of the time. And then when a subtitle appears, you go down with your gaze to look at this subtitle. And it takes time. And how much time does it take? It's a good question. We're going to investigate as well. A few hundred milliseconds, right? My my friend Jan-Louis Kruger says research shows it's about 500 milliseconds. So take 800 minus 500. So you're left with 300 milliseconds to read your subtitle. It's like one look. So obviously...
sometimes it can be three characters, but sometimes it can be 20 characters. So that's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say personally, as a subtitler for Netflix, I only use that duration for yes and no answers. Like something very, very short that you need... Like you need the flexibility of being able to use a very short subtitle, because there's a lot of dialogue that you need to include around it, but I think it's short and sweet and easy for like very, very short words, not even a sentence or three words, even if they're short, nothing like that. And they don't say anything about this in the guidelines.
That's just you, you know?
Yeah, no, they don't clarify this in the guidelines.
That's the only way to do it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my view in experience. That's what I've started doing that, because I realized that otherwise 20 frames is just not enough for anything else.
Yeah, so you know, you see, that's room for cooperation between researchers and the industry, and this is something, you know, one very specific thing in which we can contribute, you know, thanks to my tracking.
No, that was my point with the question.
They are open to suggestions. Like they update the guidelines, at least the Spanish guidelines, like twice a year with all sorts of updates. At the beginning, for example, they said ships need to be written in italics, and I don't know where that rule came from, because I have never in my life written the name of a ship in italics. It's not a work of art of any kind. It's just a proper noun. So yeah, I mean, they listen to those to the feedback we give them, and at some point it just disappeared. Like
from one update to the next, it's just not there anymore. So it evolves over time.
Yeah, and it also shows you that it's always good to raise complaints, right? And the same with the quality of subtitles. I think it's viewers should complain to Netflix and other companies if they see bad quality subtitles. Just raise this issue there.
Sure. I don't know if there's something else that you wanted to say about your last paper or...
No, maybe not my last paper, but there's this thing I can perhaps...
Your current research, yeah.
I can perhaps mention...
Damian wants more statistical details.
Of course.
I think, Agnieszka, I think we're not satisfied with your answer. We're going to need you to go deeper into that because...
No, you want to keep your listeners, right?
Our audience is disappointed now. They wanted a masterclass on statistics.
Okay, I'll give you something else that's interesting for the audience. How about this?
Perfect.
Please.
Please do.
Okay, so many of you may have heard this or may have seen this in conference presentation. I have attended numerous conference presentations where I saw this table that says that when a subtitle is displayed at the speed of 120 words per minute, viewers spend about 40% of their time in the subtitle area, but when the reading speed goes up to 200 words per minute, viewers spend as much as 80%. And then people get excited because this is like such a simple rule, and that tells you, okay, you shouldn't subtitle at 200 words per minute because it's just too fast. So everybody is, you know, so excited to have such a simple rule.
I'm excited right now.
Yeah, but I don't know. Have you heard about this? Have you seen this?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have seen it in so many different places. And I just want to say the data that I have from numerous studies doesn't show this at all.
Okay.
We know this thanks to all those eye tracking studies that we have been conducting. So, what our data shows really that if you if viewers were to spend 80% of their time in the subtitle area, the subtitling speed would have to go up to, I don't know, over 500 words per minute, which I don't think ever happens, fortunately. Okay.
For now.
Yeah. And people are looking for this, you know, holy grail. I get people coming up at conferences to me saying, oh, so what's the best reading speed? What's the best reading speed? For subtitles.
What's the best reading speed? Tell us.
It's impossible to say.
No, come on.
I can say somewhere between 12 and 20 characters per second, but then it all depends. And I think we all need to realize that it's just impossible to say because it depends who is watching, what do they know, what language are they watching in, how difficult the words are, and what's going on the screen. Yeah. So it will be different for everyone, like the speed at which people can read the subtitles. So it's just, I know people want to have one number, right? Because it's convenient for companies and you just need to set the limit. And I think this limit shouldn't go above 20 characters per second. But I think I should stop here.
But should we have one limit then? Or can we have it? Can we think about a future and when we have two limits? I mean, because if you take Netflix, for instance, you have people watching that they are 15 years old and 80 years old. So I don't know.
That's an idea that comes back, right, over and over again. Can we have different versions of subtitles? Yeah. So even I think I remember Henry Gottlieb in the 90s or early 90s proposed this idea that we should have personal subtitles, so one set of, I don't know, verbatim or literal subtitles and the other simplified, and then people would be able to choose. Would be nice, why not? But that's costly, right? So I don't...
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like, I can see that happening in the near future, I'm afraid.
Yes, I expect, you know, with new technologies, software, as my colleague Jan-Louis was telling the other day, software will be able to tell you, hey, you are using a very long and very difficult word in your subtitle. So if you have that word as a subtitler, the software will sort of, give you a red sign there saying, go down with your reading speed for this subtitle because, you know, viewers need more time. Or whenever something is, there's a lot of action on screen, and you know they should look at the screen at this particular moment, you should leave the subtitles for longer. So it's really, you know, some of it is common sense and some of them, you know, some of it will be integrated in subtitling tools in the future, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that would be the best solution, because if you want people to take into consideration all of these details, it's going to be hard without the help of technology. But it sounds plausible. So, and we're going to finish up the first part of the interview. And now I'm going to ask you pretty much the same question, but you need to answer for our younger audience, for students, for new translator, for people wanting to get into ABT, why is so helpful doing research on eye tracking?
Eye tracking helps us to verify some long-standing assumptions and beliefs that have been present in audiovisual translation since time immemorial, I think. For instance, do viewers reread subtitles?
Since the 90s?
Yes, since time immemorial.
Since the beginning of time, yeah. that is 1990.
Because we are talking to a younger audience, so it is since time immemorial for them.
Yeah, but when you open any you know subtitling book, it tells you all your subtitles ideally shouldn't cross shot changes because viewer reread subtitles on shot changes. Is that true?
It's yeah.
Not so much. Not so much. We did this study some time ago, and people just continued reading subtitles. They are more disruptive to reading, and there is something to it, but the effect wasn't that great, to be honest. That's when eye tracking comes in useful, when you can actually verify whether something is true or not. Or when you have very fast subtitles, you can see whether viewers reach the end of the subtitle, whether it just disappeared too quickly for them to be able to read the entire subtitle, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask them, they can tell you, yeah, sure, I've read everything. But when you have eye tracking, you can actually see if that was true.
If they did. Okay. Well, great. Thank you. And we're going to now do our second section of the show, Subtítulos con Carácter, with Guillermo. And after that, we'll be back with more of Agnieszka.
A todos los subtítulos les faltan caracteres, pero a los mejores nunca les falta personalidad. ¿Qué los hace tan especiales? Quédate y descúbrelo con Guillermo Parra. Bienvenido a Subtítulos con Carácter.
Saludos, curiosos y amantes de los subtítulos. Hoy voy a hablar de la película Hustle, Garra, protagonizada por Adam Sandler y que, bueno, trata sobre baloncesto. No lo voy a esconder, realmente la he escogido por eso, porque soy un gran aficionado del baloncesto y sigo la NBA desde hace muchos años. Y la verdad es que la he disfrutado mucho la película, pero al mismo tiempo, mientras la veía, lo estaba pasando mal por los traductores porque es una película muy difícil de traducir. Tiene un tecnolecto muy marcado, no solo por el deporte en sí, que hay que conocer, sino también por el mundillo, cómo se eligen los jugadores, cómo funcionan los equipos, etc. Y la verdad es que, aunque la traducción en general me ha parecido muy natural y muy buena, a nivel técnico sí es verdad que deja bastante que desear. La versión española tiene grandes aciertos, también tiene algunos elementos que no ha comprendido bien. La versión latinoamericana es un desastre de principio a fin. Voy a poner algunos ejemplos simplemente para que se entienda a lo que me refiero y también le voy a dar un poco de perspectiva, ¿vale? Porque esto no es cuestión de criticar a los traductores ni mucho menos. Empezando de lo más básico, entre comillas, a lo más difícil. hay un momento en el que ven un vídeo en redes sociales de un señor que hace el mate a pesar de que tiene 63 años, ¿no? Hacer el mate es agarrar el balón, saltar a 3 metros de altura y meterla justo por encima de la canasta hacia abajo, colgándose del aro. Entonces, claro, dicen, Dr. J still dunking when he was 63. Y le sorprende, le dicen que es una pasada, increíble, porque, bueno, porque a esa edad no es normal que salte a 3 metros de altura, ¿no? Esto en español se tradujo como el Dr. J sigue machacando a los 63, y machacar es un sinónimo que se utiliza en España para hacer un mate, que tampoco sé si se dirá en Latinoamérica. Y en la versión latinoamericana, sin embargo, dice algo tan sencillo como Dr. J encestando a sus 63. Claro, está bien que tire, ¿no? Pero la gracia está en que salta a 3 metros de altura. Eso es lo sorprendente. Vamos con un ejemplo de dificultad media. Hay un momento en el que ya están jugando a baloncesto y un atacante va hacia la canasta, va a meter canasta, y el defensor se planta en posición de defensa, se queda quieto y deja que se lo lleve por delante, que lo arrolle, porque con eso va a conseguir lo que se llama charge, ¿no? Entonces dicen, he took the charge. Took the charge es, se deja arrollar con la esperanza de que los árbitros piten falta en ataque y le devuelvan el balón a su equipo. Esto, todo esto, no se ha entendido en ninguna de las dos versiones, y en la versión española, por ejemplo, dice le ha dado, evidentemente le ha dado, pero no es esa la cuestión, y en la versión latinoamérica dice fue por el tiro, que no tiene nada que ver. Pero de hecho, una cosa que he notado es que cuando no se entendía a qué se refería este tecnicismo, pues lo simplificaba todo hasta el punto de decir que no tire, el tiro, referencias así que son muy básicas y que de hecho contrastan mucho con un entorno muy especializado. Y quería daros algún ejemplo aún más difícil, pero la verdad es que yo creo que se entiende la idea. Y aquí la reflexión que yo quiero plantear es, bueno, por un lado está la cuestión del conocimiento que pueda tener el traductor, ¿no? Que de hecho, bueno, la gestión de proyectos hasta cierto punto podría tener en cuenta la especialidad de los traductores, pero sabemos que por el volumen de traducciones que hay que hacer y de producciones es prácticamente inviable hoy en día, ¿no? Entonces, claro, por un lado está lo que pueda documentarse un traductor para suplir las carencias que tenemos todos en cualquier ámbito, y por otro lado están las facilidades que podrían poner las productoras y las distribuidoras con notas, con explicaciones, con todo esto que he hecho yo ahora en forma de nota para facilitarles la vida a los traductores y además obtener una traducción de mayor calidad. Y esto, por desgracia, no se resolverá mientras las transcripciones, las plantillas y todo las sigan haciendo profesionales independientes y sin ningún tipo de contribución o de implicación por parte de la productora, de los guionistas y de los que saben realmente del tema. Y con esta reflexión me despido. Gracias por escuchar y hasta el próximo episodio.
Thank you, Guillermo, for your section. And
you're welcome.
Agnieszka, we wanted to ask you about your professional, more professional side, your teaching side with the ABT masterclass. Can you tell us about that and how can you help with your knowledge, people trying to learn subtitling and all that?
Yes, so AVT Masterclass is this online educational space with different courses on subtitling, and we're planning to have more on audiovisual translation. We have more courses in the pipeline. These are self-paced courses most of the time. That means you can learn at any time. You don't need to attend any live classes, etc. And they are open to anyone, you know, across the globe who wants to learn subtitling. Because when you think about that, what are your options if, I don't know, you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, and I don't know, let's say you're a written text translator and you want to learn how to subtitle. Not many people want to go to university and take a master's in translation or in AVT. Okay, so what we're offering at AVT Masterclass are those continuous professional development courses, you could say, right? Or if you are already a subtitler and you want to learn subtitling for the deaf and hard of hearing. We have those courses as well. And the idea for this came together with my partners, Łukasz and one more Agnieszka, Łukasz Dudka and Agnieszka Walczak, we were, you know, teaching at various universities, various courses, companies, and we thought, you know, we have this passion and potential, and we could, like, expand in the sense that, you know, at university I have, I don't know, like 12 to 20 students, and you know, I could be, you know, teaching many more. And yeah. At the same time, everybody has heard about the talent crunch, right? And whether it's true or not, it's a different thing. But yeah, a lot of companies are looking for people who can produce different subtitles, whether it's closed captions, SDH, or interlingual, or templates, or, you know, various things. And this is where we come in with the courses.
Great. So what do you think, that everyone can take this? Do you need special preparation? I mean, because I'm asking this question because usually students wonder if they should wait until they finish the degree, or maybe they start taking courses, I don't know, in the second year, third year. What do you recommend?
I think, you know, it depends on which one, because some of the courses are, you know, geared towards a person who has never done any subtitling, or just, I don't know, false beginners in subtitling, you could say that. Then we start from scratch, you know, with the Timing 101 course. You learn about the absolute fundamentals of timing subtitles, and then various aspects related to the translation in subtitling. But we also, you know, so depending on what you already know, if you already know something and you want to learn SDH, right, then this course will be more advanced. Or if you want to learn temperate creation, we sort of assume that you already know the basics of timing and translation. So depending on where you start, you know, there are different courses that can help you. Yeah.
What is your favorite one?
It's very easy. My absolute favorite, the best course we have so far, I think, is the course on subtitling for the deaf and hard of hearing. It's not only full of, you know, those nice video lectures that we recorded for you, and everything is subtitled, by the way. We have interviews with hard of hearing viewer, with deaf viewers. We have more interviews, and we have lots of hands-on exercises and materials. And this is my absolute favorite. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great. So tell us how can people get in touch with you or see more information about the courses and all that.
Yeah, the easiest way is just to go to our website, which is avtmasterclass.com, and you'll see the entire offer, all the courses. There are some bundles, so when you buy two courses together, it's just cheaper. We also have big courses and we have mini courses. So if you're not sure whether you want to spend the money, you don't know us, but you don't know whether it's, like, you know, worth anything. So maybe a mini course would be to start with. So everything is on the website. You can also follow us on social media or drop us an email.
Great. Excellent. So to start with the second part and to finish with the interview, we wanted to ask you about several topics that you mentioned during your keynote speak at the Languages in the Media 2021. Your subject was ABT after the pandemic. So when I talk about that, the first question that we have is regarding this shift to streaming consumption. You know that you mentioned how everyone during the pandemic stayed home watching Netflix or whatever. What effect that, because companies have been growing. I mean, Netflix now lost some subscriptions, but I mean, they are really big, and now we have many, many more companies. And what's the effect of this for translators, for the academia, for the industry in general?
That's a good question. Now I have an impression that everybody forgot about the pandemic and they just, you know, stopped watching Netflix or other services. No. And they just want to go on holiday to Greece or, you know. But no, obviously, when during lockdown, a lot of people stayed in and a lot of them were watching something on streaming services. So there was enormous growth. And so that this was like good news for those companies, and other companies have realized there's money in it. So there was this change of mindset as well, right? When you think about your parents, my parents, they watch traditional, I think, I don't know, my parents at least watch traditional linear television, right? Whatever is there in front of them at the time that it's there. And I think this with the younger people, It's just completely different, and the companies are realizing this. So everybody wants to have their own streaming platform now, right? So there's much more competition.
Even CNN tried it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people realize this is where young people are, right? So more and more people, not only young, but you know, well, myself included. So I'm not that young, but yeah. And the pandemic, I think, initially what happened was that there was no new content, right? So there was, I don't know, dubbing studios were closed, recording studios were closed. So there was this situation where companies had to go back to their old catalog and try to retrieve whatever was there. And since lockdown was continuing, they came up with those, or they made those workflows that were there before, but more mainstream, particularly the cloud workflows, right, for remote recording of dubbing in particular, right, because subtitling, I suppose it's a bit different, more problematic was dubbing.
I mean, it's obvious that it was very good for companies, localization companies, because this growth means that they have more work and all that, but there's this situation with the so-called talent crunch and the money that actually companies are paying for to translators and all that. So how do you think it's possible that something that is so good for companies because we have more content can actually not be that good for translators?
Yeah, I don't think I have an answer to this, to be honest.
Nice.
I think I've been observing what's going on, and I think the professional translators, subtitlers organizations have been heard. Now they've been saying this for some time now, but now I feel their voice is being heard better.
Yeah.
In a way, so they're saying, right, there is no talent crunch, you're just paying bad rates, crappy rates, right? So nobody wants to work for you. And I think we all know that there are companies on the market that, you know, praise quality, they want to have quality content, and they're willing to pay more. And there are those companies, they just want to have everything cheaply, which I think is just short-sighted in the long term. Because maybe there will be a point where viewers will just, you know, stop buying the services because of the quality, right? But at the same time,
that's something there that the people can say, okay, this is not good because of a bad translation.
You can complain. I mean, there is a button or something. There
no,
is...
no, but I mean, if people realize that they actually, I don't know if, I don't want to say if they care. I mean, I want to say, do they know that there is not
they
a good translation?
They probably don't know, but maybe they, without knowing, they just stop watching.
Okay.
Right? Okay. I remember I was watching this with my daughter, who is 11, this film, for teenagers, and there was like something funny going on. I couldn't quite picture. It was like, you know, put a, what's wrong here? And then it turned out it was like a Brazilian show in Portuguese that was dubbed into English. And, you know, this English was just so bad. So we just stopped watching. So most people, I knew why we stopped watching, but most people would just stop watching without realizing. So, you know, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I would encourage everyone to complain, you know, to the company. So, so that they...
Translators do complain. We do.
Yeah, but viewers,
we mean, like to complain.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there is a new, probably this change also, or this difference between those professional subtitlers, translators who have been on the market for 20, 30 years. And their position is very good. And obviously, they don't want to change things apart from the rates going up. But there are other young people who are just entering the market without those, I don't want to say preconception, but that's preconception was the only word that comes to my mind right now. So they're like, they don't have anything against the templates, for instance, right? Or they do use machine translation and they're happy mm-hmm. to edit it. Okay, so there are those differences in the mindset, let's say, in those new people who are entering the profession. And I'm quite interested to see what comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you talked about during your presentation, and you actually mentioned it already here, is are the remote workflows. Do you know if what part of that is going to continue, or do you have an opinion on what can continue for the future? I mean, talents recording themselves at home and all that. Is this something that we can hope for the future?
I think this is not going to go away because now as a company with those remote workflows, you have access to all the talent across the globe. Mm-hmm. Some of it, of course, is cheaper, which is quite important to some companies, right?
Yeah.
So I think even you know, from this perspective, those workflows are going to stay and the technology is getting better and better. As well, because previously, right, I don't know, 10 years ago, somebody told you, oh, people won't be recording dubbing in the studio. You think, no, that would be such a bad quality. Now, it's, you know, not that bad, probably.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Latin America, for instance, it can be very helpful for people working in different parts of different countries, because most of the content is recorded in Mexico, and so they do with mostly people from Mexico. But now it's easier for people in Argentina, in Chile, in whatever they are, to be part of projects that before they were not able to be part of because they were simply not there. So
that's an excellent example. Yeah,
I hope it stays.
I'm interested in knowing if dubbing studios provide any sort of materials like microphones, or they explain their workers how to isolate a room, or how to have good acoustics so that they can record. How does that work? Because apart from the software,
I don't know. You'd have to ask the dubbing companies. I'm not able to say, but you know, maybe good companies would provide some good quality equipment, whereas some bad companies would just, you know, just take advantage.
To have it yourself.
Of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is just like, you know, what happened to other professions as well, like myself included, right? I was teaching for university students from home, and I was paying my own electricity bills, my own better internet connection, my own better noise cancelling headphones, etc., right? So hopefully this will not be taken, you know, advantage of, yeah.
So here in Argentina, what we see is that some people decided to create in their own studio, in a way, at home, mainly because they're actually using it to do something else, you know, because since they are freelancers as well, and then it's better, they have better opportunities to work for publicities and all that. So I don't know. I think that at some point, it's great that if companies are providing those tools for people at home, but if you're a translator, they don't provide a good connection, they don't provide a good computer, so we can also ask for that, you know.
Sometimes they provide glossaries.
But talking about recording at home and voices, one thing I have observed is the rise in synthetic voices. And obviously what we are focusing on in this discussion is entertainment type of content for which artificial voices hopefully won't be used.
I would bet on that.
Well, that's the thing, but they're getting better and better, right?
Yeah.
That's one thing. And maybe, you know, not all type of content requires the highest premium quality of localization. Maybe there is some, you know, not public facing content that needs to be localized that, you know, could use some artificial voices. Sorry. Yeah, so some companies are using those artificial voices, you know, if they have a choice, provide localization or not provide localization and provide with artificial voices, they would just go for for this.
So another, if you don't know, you can give us your opinion and that's it. But another thing that worries about the future and about this world we are living in after the pandemic is that the usage of machine translation, which you also briefly mentioned today. So what translators want to know if they should be worried about their future with this technology.
Yes and no, depending
yes and no. Okay.
Depending on how flexible you are, because obviously what is going to happen, machine translation will get better and better, and more people will have to turn from subtitlers from scratch to post editors. But I think, again, it's we're going to see a generational difference there, with younger people accepting more and more willingly automated workflows. And it's only not only machine translation, but automatic spotting. I've been using several tools that use AI to time subtitles and to create transcription. And if you have like one speaker, clear voice, video, these are excellent. That's how I create my subtitles, you know, for AVT Masterclass videos. So they are excellent. And here I have to say we just finished with my colleague David Orego Carmona, who came to Warsaw, to the University of Warsaw, to teach this course on automation and post-editing in subtitling. So I was, course, I was entirely devoted to, you know, those automated workflows. And most people, most students said, you know, they are going to use those automation tools, including MT. Now they are able to realize what type of content is better suited for this and how perhaps you can prepare your text, pre-edit it, so that you get better quality in terms of MT. But I think if you're, you know, prepared to admit a little bit of technology into your workflow, then you will have a job.
I think that you just have to accept that it's going to be different, and I don't think that anyone can say how different, or I mean, you can say there can be more post-editing or more automation in this and that, but really nobody knows, because I mean, the technology is very good, but we've been hearing about machine translation since the 1950s. So we just don't really know, but we know that it will change. And that
I expect will happen is I expect more integration of all those speech recognition based spotting, transcription, or machine translation into subtitling tools. right? Mm-hmm. So now when you think about that, I work a lot with Easy Titles and a little bit with Una. You know, you can't have cut tools there, right? At the moment, it's just not integrated, or, you know, MT is not integrated really. I mean, just into some of these tools only, right? So I would expect this something that is going to happen. So some sort of integration of subtitling tools and other tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least for translation memories and terminology bases, we've been expecting that for 10 years or so. So
it's time they did something about this now, right?
Yeah.
Proprietary software already has that. There are some softwares for subtitling that belong to specific companies that do have machine translation, and they do have translation memories, and so that already exists, kind of, but
for
it's
translation
not
memory,
commercialized.
I don't know if you mean MemoQ or Trados, it's still like a Trados tool rather than subtitling tool, right?
No, I'm referring. I'm currently working with two subtitling tools that include machine translation and also
those are not available
memory,
for the public.
But they belong to specific companies. Belong to. Mm-hmm. It's not commercialized. It's not something that you can pay for openly.
Yeah. I mean, there are some online tools that are commercially available, right? That have machine translation integrated from scratch.
You know, that's yeah.
But I'm just saying, in those traditional subtitling tools,
no,
not there yet.
No, of course.
No. And but I think that it means that they would need to make a bigger change, and maybe with speech recognition and all that, it's going to be able to make it easier. Yes, I mean, Guiche was referring to something that's very specific. If you work for a company in particular, but we also know that we need to analyze what's available for the public. So,
for sure. But what I'm saying is that what you're theorizing
already
exists.
It's
already there.
No. I mean, if even on free software on subtitle edit, you can already have machine translation, and we've had that.
Yeah, that's nicely integrated.
Now the quality is another thing, but we do have it. Okay, so Agnieszka, thank you for your time. We want to finish our interview talking about the ABT after the pandemic for researchers. You are a researcher, that's what you do mostly now. If there's, I don't know, a specific difference that you see now? I mean, we've always been collaborating across the globe in this regard, but I don't know if there's something in particular that you can see for the future of research after the pandemic.
After the pandemic, I think we're very happy to actually go back to the lab and try to invite participants, because, you know, we couldn't do any research when the lab was closed, and with eye tracking, it's a bit tricky. So, you know, there is hope for more online eye tracking through
the
webcam,
cloud eye tracking,
which is
possible
now.
Yes, I was just kidding. Yeah.
So online, you know, eye tracking would be something nice, but the current quality is not.
That's mostly what I meant. It's not available now. Something like that.
Yeah. I think everybody's just happy to see one another in person, you know, at conference and stuff. So there's this joy, you also start appreciating simple things there. And something I'm hoping for the future, not necessarily related to the pandemic, but maybe pandemic has made us realize how important accessibility is, ensuring accessibility for all. So before the pandemic, I don't know, 2019, I didn't even know what Zoom was, right? And now we know all those tools, and they started integrating, for instance, live subtitling. Automatic still, but, you know, it's better than nothing. And still, you could also add functionality with human-made subtitling. So there is more and more, there are more and more tools that ensure accessibility for all sorts of users. So that's something that makes me very happy, and I hope we'll continue with this in that direction.
Yeah. So in research, you also see a spike in this area? I mean, is there's more research now on accessibility due to the fact that more companies are considering it?
Possibly, yes. I haven't done research on this, so.
Okay, no, sir. Have to do research to ask to be asked questions. You know, to answer our questions. you can give your opinion.
Anna Matamala would say, "I don't have the answer for that. I will wait until I finish my research, and then I'll
research."
So that's something probably I had in mind. I suppose yes. Accessibility. Is one thing, and then legislation perhaps is changing as well during accessibility. I don't know if you heard, right? The UK government, right, was taken to court for not having their press releases or briefings accessible with sign language interpreting. Yeah, so things are are becoming, users are becoming also more. What's the word?
Aware,
yes, and they demand. Yeah. They are not afraid to demand, their rights. Mm. And for me, one hope would also be that different guidelines, including subtitling guidelines, that they will be based on research evidence. And I'm hoping for more cooperation between academia and industry.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, well, Agnieszka, thank you very much for giving us your precious time for this interview. We had a great time, and thank you. Looking forward to talking to you in person in Berlin.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Hopefully, there will be people who stay till the end and haven't switched off at the Linux models part. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Cámaras y computadoras listas. Llegó el momento de experimentar. Entremos en el laboratorio audiovisual con Damián Santilli.
Les doy la bienvenida al laboratorio audiovisual número 32. Hoy vamos a adelantarnos un poco al segundo Congreso Hispanoamericano de Traducción Audiovisual, el HISPATAV 2, que se llevará a cabo en Buenos Aires el 30 de septiembre y 1 de octubre, y hablaremos de un tema que estará muy presente, la traducción automática. En este caso, les voy a contar acerca de un estudio del que tuve el placer de participar el año pasado para la empresa Aptec, una de las líderes en el desarrollo de traducción automática para TAB y subtitulado en particular. En el estudio, tuve la posibilidad de comparar la traducción automática de Aptec contra la de Google en la traducción al inglés de una serie mexicana. El experimento era muy sencillo. Por un lado, hice la traducción de un episodio entero con 814 subtítulos con Google Translate, mediante Subtitle Edit. Luego, envié los subtítulos en español a Aptec para que ellos produjeran su traducción al inglés. Una vez hecho esto, generé un documento de tres columnas, una con el texto original y otras dos columnas con las traducciones. Ambas columnas tenían las traducciones con resultados mezclados tanto de Google como de Aptec. Con esto pasé uno por uno por los 814 subtítulos para ir definiendo en cada instancia qué versión me servía más. Más adelante les cuento cuál de las dos empresas ganó, pero hablemos primero de cómo tomamos las decisiones para posedición. Sin dudas, lo más importante es ahorrar tiempo en comparación a traducir de cero. Si no estamos ahorrando nada de tiempo, no sirve de nada. No obstante, para este proyecto, en algunos casos ninguna de las dos traducciones me servía y entonces tuve que elegir la que más se acercase al significado del original y también la que segmentara de la mejor manera. En la comparativa analicé diferentes aspectos y el primero fue la segmentación. En diferentes ejemplos encontré que Google tenía una mayor tendencia a romper las unidades de sentido mientras que Aptec optaba por no hacerlo y con más frecuencia generar subtítulos de una sola línea sin hacer ninguna división. Si bien en algunos ejemplos Google segmentó mejor, el ganador en este rubro fue Aptec, aunque eso era de esperarse por ser una herramienta enfocada a la traducción automática para subtítulos. El segundo rubro fue la traducción de nombres y lugares, que abundaban en la serie en cuestión. Curiosamente, para nombres que no tenían una clara versión en inglés, como Elena, Nico, Gina o Nelson, los programas siempre los dejaron en el idioma original. Mientras que para nombres como Pedro, siempre se tradujeron como Peter. Incluso un señor Domingo se convirtió en Sunday. Obviamente también hubo traducciones con tinte humorístico, como en un caso donde se usaba la forma Catita para referirse a Catalina y se lo tradujo como Pussy. En los nombres de lugares también hubo problemas. Por ejemplo, la fonda Cazuela de Lola se tradujo como Lola's Cazuela. El tercer rubro del análisis fue el tratamiento. En líneas generales podemos decir que para los sistemas de traducción automática es mucho más fácil lidiar con lenguaje formal, por lo que podríamos intuir que para, por ejemplo, documentales, estos servicios podrían ser más útiles. Pero la serie que tocó analizar tenía mucho lenguaje informal y diferencias de tratamientos, y también había mucho idioma regional con algunos personajes muy divertidos que crearon enigmas insondables tanto para AppTech como para Google. Algunos ejemplos. Un "ella va a quedar rendida a tus pies" se tradujo por AppTech como "she will be rendered at your feet" y por Google como "it's going to be late at your feet". Y un "métele enjundia a la labia" fue traducido por AppTech como "just stick it in your mouth" y por Google como "just put some substance in your mouth". Por último, los resultados. De los 814 subtítulos, elegí a AppTech en 464 subtítulos, a Google en 211 subtítulos y a ambos en 139. De las traducciones se pueden inferir muchas cosas y sin dudas es un tema que da para mucho debate, pero sí está muy claro que en la post-edición debemos trabajar muchísimo en evitar que la traducción sea extremadamente artificial, en particular en contextos informales en donde a la máquina todavía le cuesta una enormidad levantar vuelo y despegarse del original. Y hasta aquí llegamos con el laboratorio audiovisual de hoy. Pueden seguirme y ponerse en contacto en mi cuenta de Instagram, @tradugeek, o en Twitter en d-santili. Hasta la próxima. Muchas gracias, Damián, por el laboratorio audiovisual. Excelente episodio, este último episodio de la temporada. Y bueno,
y no, ¿qué solo les pareció? Lo dice él, yo también lo digo.
Ah, lo hice,
damos,
lo hice.
Damos apoyo a tu idea, Damián.
Ah, muy bien, muy bien. Bueno, cuéntenme, Guille, ¿qué te pareció la entrevista con Agnieszka?
Pues debo decir que me encanta tener este tipo de invitados porque a veces, bueno, en traducción es fácil quedarse en la parte esta de descriptiva o de mira, esta traducción se hizo así o asá, y que está muy bien, por cierto, yo he hecho una tesis sobre eso y a mí me encanta la descripción, Patrick, no me lo tengas en cuenta. Pero sí que hay toda una parte desconocida de la investigación experimental y de cómo puede ayudar a promover cambios informados en las prácticas del sector y acabar con mitos, ¿no? Con ideas preconcebidas que tenemos sobre cómo deben ser las cosas, a lo mejor de los años 90, o vete tú a saber de cuándo, de lo que dijo un señor hace X décadas, y luego resulta que en realidad a lo mejor no hay una razón de peso para hacer eso y estamos todos aquí de alguna forma condicionados por estas convenciones, pero luego bueno, llega una investigación, bueno, no una, idealmente más de una para que pueda replicarse los resultados y demás y corroborarlo, y nos dice que no, que podemos cambiar de hábitos y eso es muy sano y me parece genial que se haga hincapié en ello en el podcast.
Blanca.
Sí, yo creo que ha sido invitada de lujo, ¿no? Ha sido el colofón de la temporada. Después, bueno, vamos a tener este último episodio con los invitados sorpresa, pero pero yo creo que no podíamos acabar de una manera mejor. Y ha estado, o sea, hemos aprendido mucho. Creo que es una persona muy divulgativa. De hecho, seguramente por eso, ¿no? Fue, yo creo, la ponente plenaria del Languages and the Media virtual, porque justamente es una persona pues que, en la línea de lo que estaba diciendo ahora Guillermo, sabe relacionar muy bien las novedades que hay en el mundo profesional con novedades en investigación y eso se le nota, hemos notado en la entrevista también, ¿no? Este punto que decíamos tipo Ana Matamala de no respondo si no tengo los datos, pero que todos los datos que tiene los comparte de una manera muy clara y no sé, da gusto escucharla, la verdad, a mí me ha gustado mucho.
Sí, sí, sí. No, y me quedo con un poco la idea, continuando lo que decía Guille también y vos, Blanca, de que también estaría bueno, que esto lo charlamos en el episodio, que esta investigación que pueda derribar algún mito o cuestiones establecidas de décadas también se incorpore a la práctica, ¿no? Eso es algo que está muy bien, es un llamado también que nosotros hacemos desde este lugar en función de los entrevistados que tenemos, que fuimos haciendo en esta temporada y en la temporada anterior, de mezclar la gente profesional con gente de la academia, y creo que también si se hacen cosas para tener en cuenta, me quedo muy grabado lo que dijo, por ejemplo, del tiempo que uno demora en llegar con los ojos al subtítulo, ¿no? Esos 500 milisegundos de los que habló Agnieszka, y que uno dice, bueno, la realidad es que esas cosas está buena, que también después, con todo el trabajo que implica, la inversión de tiempo y de dinero que tienen en los académicos y los años que se dedica a esto, que también después se incorpore en las normas de trabajo, así que ojalá que eso también sea algo que podamos llegar a ver de cara al futuro. Y hasta aquí llegamos entonces con el episodio de hoy. Recuerden visitar a nuestro patrocinador Una en su sitio web una.net y registrarse para las 4 semanas de prueba. Recuerden también que pueden encontrar toda la información del podcast en nuestro sitio web www.ensincroniapodcast.com y también en YouTube, donde haremos en vivo el episodio 33, fin de temporada, la semana que viene. Y que nos pueden encontrar a nosotros también en LinkedIn, Twitter e Instagram. Hasta la próxima.